Hello and welcome back to Your Politics Show here on Mix 92.6 FM. This is Your Politics Show because we talk about national and local issues, but the main thrust of the conversation is directed by your questions that you send in all through the month, and we put them to the local politicians. We try to get the best answers and help with local issues. So do remember, before we get into the show, that you can email in at any time if you have any questions to put to our Labour, Liberal Democrat or Conservative MPs, and we will answer them through our social media or through our emails. This week we're speaking to local Liberal Democrat MP Daisy Cooper. Welcome back to the show, Daisy. In our first interview of 2023, we must address the crisis in the NHS. There were 2004 excess deaths over the five-year average in the week to January 6th across the UK. There are record waiting lists, record lengths of times waiting for ambulances, and horror stories of the conditions for nurses, doctors, and patients. This is a situation that requires short and long-term changes, but what can be done? What needs to be done?
Well, it's a great question. And I've been talking about this, you know, quite a lot over the last few weeks. Fundamentally, the major issue we have is that our social care sector is broken and deeply underfunded. And what that means is that, you know, with an aging population and people who are living longer, but also getting iller, many people go into hospital, but they can't get out of hospital. This is the problem with delayed discharge. So at the moment, there are lots of people in hospital who are medically fit to leave if they could get either into a care home or go back to their own home and have domiciliary care in their own home. But because there aren't enough care workers, because there aren't enough care beds, it's been really difficult to do that. And so people who could leave hospital are stuck in hospital. And that means it's been very hard to admit new people who are ill. And if you can't admit new people, that then there's a backlog of people in the back of ambulances. And if the ambulances are stuck outside a hospital, they can't then go and reach people who need their urgent help. So it's created this real kind of backlog throughout the entire system. So the single most important thing that the government could do right now would be to sort out the challenges in social care. The government has announced additional funds, but the money that it announced last year, only 40% of that money has actually reached the front line. 60% of it hasn't. There's an extra 200 million that they've made available, but we're not sure how much of that money has reached the front line either. So the government seems to be, once again, really behind the curve. So fixing social care is the most important thing, but obviously there's lots of other things that could be done as well. We've got to sort out the workforce crisis because we don't have enough doctors, nurses, social care workers, paramedics. We need to make sure that we can resolve the strikes by coming to a fair pay deal. And fundamentally, the government needs to look at how it's going to fund our health and social care services for the future.
Maybe one of the answers could be with local pharmacists. This is something you met with local pharmacists this month to discuss the future of community pharmacies. Do you believe that they can play a role in helping with the NHS's problems?
Yeah, pharmacists could play an enormous role in helping. So in Scotland, for example, they have something called Pharmacy First, and it does what it says on the tin. It encourages people to go to the pharmacy as their first port of call. And that's something that I would really like to see rolled out here in England as well. The fact is that at the moment, there are many repeat prescriptions that could be easily dealt with by pharmacists rather than people having to go to their GPs. They could have more prescribing rights as well. We need to see an investment in IT so that anything that does happen with a pharmacist can be plugged into a central system so GPs can keep an eye on their patients, obviously. But there's lots of things that pharmacists could be doing. And you know, you end up in this sort of crazy situation where maybe somebody's been on a repeat prescription for, say, 6 or 7 years, and they accidentally forget to put in a repeat prescription, and it's a Friday night and they're about to run out. But the pharmacist is open all day Saturday and often on a Sunday. And there are lots of pharmacies that are open late into the evening, and yet people can't get them until Monday morning until their GP reopens. It's just crazy. So there's lots of things we could do to use pharmacies, as I say, for prescriptions, for treating sort of minor ailments, and potentially doing lots of public health preventative work as well, whether that's checking people's blood pressure and you know, other sort of vital signs, as it were.
Let's turn our attention then to the kind of big debates going on in terms of spending, and political analysts are stating that the electorate can't see much of the difference in the ideas of Keir Starmer and Rishi Sunak. Many economists have taken to task the idea that spending must be balanced like a household. Keynesian economists like Paul
Krugman have explained that instead of trying to reduce public deficits in a recession, the government should increase spending, helping businesses to grow and providing employment. Government debt will rise, of course, but the government can run fiscal surpluses to pay it down when growth returns. Austerity is for the good times, Paul Krugman says, not the bad times. Would the Liberal Democrats commit to widespread spending in terms of long-term projects?
So that's a difficult question to answer, because let's try and unpack it a little bit. So I guess the first thing I would say is that there are sort of limits. I think trying to explain the economy in terms of a household budget, it's helpful for people to do that if it helps them to understand decisions that are being made. But there are limits in terms of how you can do that, because it's not a direct parallel. I guess what I would say is that my party and I are in favour of borrowing when it's productive borrowing. And I mean sort of productive in an economic sense. So if you borrow to create, to invest in something that creates growth, that is a good way to borrow money. And you borrow to invest to then produce GDP. And that would be something like, you know, investing in the trains, for example, or investing in infrastructure. Those are the kind of things where it makes sense to borrow. But where you sort of have regular expenditure, whether that's on, you know, children's education, or whether it's colleges, or whether it's our NHS, you know, you need to be raising, bringing money in, you know, through taxes, to pay for that. So those are kind of the kind of broad sort of rules that I would describe. I think the challenge we have at the moment is the mini budget, which happened in the autumn when Liz Truss was prime minister, really just blew a hole in the economy, and it really drove up inflation really, really high. And now, as a result of that, people are really suffering. People are really, really suffering. And the damage of that mini budget is really now starting to be felt in communities up and down the country, including here in St Albans, because councils have suffered from the increase in inflation, and they're now having to balance their books, and they're having to cut all kinds of services. And that's going to be really painful and be damaging in every part of the country. So in terms of what, you know, we would look at, I mean, you know, we will have a fully costed manifesto at the next general election. There's a long time until that general election happens. So in terms of what the government decides to do, we'll look at those various things. But we have a real problem at the moment, which is that the government has failed to invest in things for such a long time that pretty much everything's broken at the same time. So, you know, our sewerage system isn't big enough to cope, you know, with all the new houses that we're building. The trains don't always work effectively and efficiently. There's just so many, you know, our hospitals are crumbling down in some places, and the same with schools. And so I think what I would say is, as in terms of sort of economic principles, we definitely would borrow for productive things, things that are economically productive that will drive growth and GDP. But you know, clearly what we need to do is make sure that whilst inflation remains high, we need to make sure that there are fair decisions about who is paying for, you know, who's going to basically suffer the brunt of that. And my big concern, and the concern of my party right now, is that the government continues to allow the weight of the cost of living crisis to fall on the shoulders of those people who are least able to cope. And that's why we continue to advocate for a proper windfall tax on the big oil and gas companies, so that we can then raise more money from that, support people with their energy bills and by insulating homes. It's why we advocate for various tax loops to be closed to pay for other things that should be support, you know, to support people who are not coping and who have been impacted the most. So my concern at the moment isn't about sort of the long term investment. It's about the decisions the government is making at the moment in terms of who suffers and who can afford to pay.
In terms of finances, then we'll move it on to an individual's finances. And this Nadeem Zahawi situation is ever changing. It seems to have a new kind of crux to it every day. Last summer, Mr. Zahawi dismissed reports of a HMRC investigation as smears and threatened some who intended to raise questions about his tax affairs. And Mr. Zahawi has said he maintains he behaved properly, but it has been reported that Nadeem Zahawi has paid more than £1 million to Revenue and Customs to settle a tax dispute. Now, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has ordered his ethics advisor to investigate how Zahawi resolved a tax dispute whilst he was Chancellor. Why is this such an important issue, Daisy?
Well, there's a couple of reasons, to be honest. The first is that he was the Chancellor for a period of time last year. And we're sort of still trying to work out what happened when. But it appears that there could have been a conflict of interest. And there certainly could have been the appearance of a conflict of interest. And those things are barred under the ministerial code. So there's a genuine question here about whether he's breached that or not. The other reason this really matters is because when allegations were made about his tax affairs, which now appear to be true, when those allegations were made, he sent very threatening legal letters to the people that made those allegations. We need this investigation because it's not clear whether or not he took advice from the government about, or from the cabinet, about whether or not he should send those legal letters. But certainly it appears as though he should have requested permission before sending them, and it's not clear whether or not he did that. But in any event, it's really quite worrying that a minister would use the threat of legal action to try and silence people who are trying to expose something that's in the public interest.
So continuing with discussions about the Conservative government, earlier this month, they blocked the Scottish Parliament's gender recognition reform bill. There have been different reactions across the political spectrum, but in terms of the Labour Party, so the opposition party, there's people within that group as well who were disappointed. LGBT plus Labour said they were deeply disappointed with the lack of support of their own leader, Keir Starmer, has given. What is the Liberal Democrats' position on this, though?
So there are two parts to this debate. The first part is around the actual changes in terms of how people can access a gender recognition certificate in Scotland. And then there are the constitutional issues that arise as a result of this happening in Scotland. So, I mean, in terms of the content of what's changed, I think what's important to say is there's no new law in Scotland that changes the Equality Act. There's nothing that changes the rights of trans people or anything that's in the, or single sex spaces or anything that's already covered by the Equality Act. And for about 20 years, we have had a system that allows trans people to have their gender recognised in law. Now, the Conservative government concluded in 2018, so just over 4 years ago, that the current process was too bureaucratic and that it was too intrusive. And it was a Conservative government that suggested there should be some changes. And there was a real cross-party consensus about that. That clearly has broken down. But those changes that initially the Conservative government had proposed have now gone through in Scotland. And as I say, it's really about how a trans person can obtain that certificate. It doesn't change what that person can do with the certificate or change their rights about what they do when they have it. So that's the kind of the content of the issue. The other issue is the constitutional one. And the government says it has legal advice saying that this is going to affect rights in across the whole of the UK, but they won't publish that legal advice. And so we don't know what the legal advice says. The government also said very quickly after Scotland passed this law that it was going to challenge it. So it looks as if this is a politically motivated thing to do rather than necessarily a legal one. But my view is that it's actually wrong for the Conservative government to undermine a cross-party decision of the Scottish Parliament in this way. And I think the government in doing this are playing fast and loose with the future of the UK itself and the future of our union. And that's not something that the Liberal Democrats would ever do.
And in terms of it then as well, you talked about the political repercussions, but do you think as well that in terms of the morals of the lives of trans people, you've suggested there that you think it's a political motivation for it. Do you think that it's unfair that trans issues are being used for political reasons rather than, seen as a human right and discussing them for their own merits rather than political point scoring?
Yeah, I mean, I think fundamentally, this is a very sensitive issue. And we're talking about people who, in the main, have probably struggled most of their lives growing up because they've been born into the wrong body. and they are struggling with that issue. We know that a lot of trans people suffer from mental ill health as a result, that they struggle to get access to the healthcare support that they need. And it's an incredibly difficult and long process to decide that you want to transition and to possibly come out as being trans as well. And so, you know, we need to talk in very sensitive terms about this, and we need to recognise that people are impacted by the way that this debate is held. There are strong views on all sides. People have a right to express their different views and beliefs, but I do worry that this whole debate has become incredibly toxic. I think for the vast majority of people, want people to live happy and healthy lives. And I think the vast majority of people, and polling backs this up, the polling that I've seen anyway, suggests that the vast majority of people recognise that, you know, people can be trans and that they should have the right to access certificates and they should have the right to live their lives as they choose. Personally, I don't see a conflict between women's rights and trans rights, which some people say exists. I don't see that. I have looked into this issue in a lot of detail. I've discussed it with different people who have different views on this issue. I've looked into it myself. And the Equality Act, you know, does have provision for single-sex spaces and other protections as well, which doesn't affect this particular issue. So this particular issue, as I say, doesn't change anything in the Equality Act. It doesn't change anybody's rights. All it does is make the process of somebody getting a certificate less bureaucratic and less intrusive.
Let's turn our attention to your own party's politics. And early in the month, you spoke to the Times Red Box podcast about the success of the Lib Dems and why you've stated you're a campaigning force to be reckoned with. This links with a community question from Joanne, and we're skipping a little bit ahead here into the community questions, but she did ask, I'm excited for the Lib Dems and love what you are doing, presenting a proper opposition unlike Labour. Have you got some great candidates lined up for the general election? I don't know if you want to give too much away. You know, when I speak to Bambos and Bim as well, you're all kind of cagey about releasing too much, but do you have some amazing kind of inspirational candidates for the whenever that general election is?
Yeah, we really do. And we're, you know, I mean, every political party is starting to select their parliamentary candidates. It's funny if the other two are being coy, because I love talking about our parliamentary candidates in other seats, and I can't wait to have them on the green benches in the House of Commons. I'll just mention two or three. There's a fantastic woman called Pippa, a good friend of mine in South Cambridgeshire. Hopefully she'll win her seat there off the Tories. She's a real environmentalist and climate activist, and should be a fantastic MP for that area. There's a guy called Josh Babarinde who is standing for election in Eastbourne. He's Eastbourne born and bred. He has been a sort of entrepreneur, set up a charity supporting people. It was called Cracked It, and he got people who come out of prison to fix broken phone screens. And so it's a sort of job enterprise, second chance kind of initiative. But he's doing fantastic work in Eastbourne, where they were the, you know, as a local councillor as well, I think his local council was the first to declare a cost of living emergency in the country. So that was really profound. We've got, you know, lots of other really good candidates in other parts of the country, but they're just a couple that who I'm working with, who I've known for some time, and really, really, really hope that they get elected next time around.
There you go. For Joanne, that could be positive news there. I don't want to put words into her mouth. Now, before we move into the community questions, we have a very tough topic, a local topic. And for some listeners, this may be upsetting. So you can tune out for a few minutes if this topic is triggering for you. But we're going to talk about the case of David Carrick. He has now pleaded guilty to a total of 49 offences, including rape, sexual assault, coercive control, and false imprisonment. You spoke in Parliament about how this case shows that the government needs to reform policing. What can you tell us on this, Daisy?
Well, as you say, this is a very really upsetting case. And even though David Carrick was a Met police officer, a lot of his crimes, many of them took place in Hertfordshire, because he lived in Hertfordshire. And so it's entirely possible that some of your listeners you know, may be affected or will know people who are affected by this particular case. I think there are a number of things that need to happen, and I hope this goes without saying, but I will say it anyway, that, you know, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of incredibly dedicated police officers who do a fantastic job, who keep us safe, who investigate local crimes, who are active in supporting community groups and community initiatives and protecting vulnerable people. But the fact is that trust in the police keeps getting knocked. It's been really eroded away, and it's made worse by these really horrific cases. And I think the really big issue that this has thrown up really is around vetting before people, when people join the police force and when they move from force to force, and what action is taken when these reports exist. So, for example, you know, the government is currently, you know, one of its manifesto pledges was to have an extra 20,000 police officers. And there are genuine concerns that because the government is rushing to recruit extra police officers, that they're not actually doing proper vetting and they're not putting the vetting in place. Now, police officers who I know have said to me that, you know, the vetting isn't anything like as extensive as it used to be. And it's, you know, it's often done on, you know, sort of psychometric testing and job applications rather than actually spending time with the person who's applying to join the force and just seeing their behaviour and how they are on the job. So vetting is a huge part of it. But then there's also the question about when people know that there are concerns. So if, you know, if other colleagues in the police force, you know, hear stuff, what do they do about it? And there are big questions to be answered about whether relevant police forces acted on the information that they had. And this issue is now going to be looked at as part of a broader inquiry. And we'll all, you know, wait to see what that inquiry says. But it's clear that in the Met and potentially other police forces as well, that there are really serious problems about vetting, about the lack of vetting when a police officer moves from one force to another, and about the speed at which recruitment is potentially happening. So there's a whole range of different issues here that the government needs to look at.
And if anybody has been affected by issues linked to this or similar sorts of issues, you can check out the NHS website. There's a lot of information for victims of crimes similar to this. And also there's some great groups in the St. Albans area, so that we'll put that information up on the website when this goes live. But let's continue into the community questions. Sarah has opened it up by saying, are you excited with the Westminster Lodge gym that it's had a refurbishment, and will you be visiting?
Yeah. So the last time I was at Westminster Lodge was just before Christmas. It was the Salmon Disabled Swimming Club were doing a swimathon. And I popped down to sort of cheer a few people on. But I didn't know that the gym part had a refurb. I'm not a big gym user. I have been for a run a few times this year already, but I might have a little look when I'm walking past.
I don't know which specific bits. I think the cafe got a refurbishment as well. So maybe you want to pop in there as well and grab a coffee or something. Catherine has moved it on to tax breaks, though, specifically for private schools. She said, how is there any justification for tax breaks for private schools? It's beyond idiotic. Those people are privileged enough and depriving state schools of money. Very strong words there from Catherine. I don't know if you fully agree with such strong words, but yeah, what is your opinion on this?
Well, I think the answer to improving education in the state sector is to invest more in our state education. That's really what we ought to be doing. And education budgets haven't kept up. And, you know, it really is an outrage that in, you know, 2023 and in somewhere, you know, like St. Albans and everywhere, that parents are being asked to pay for some of the basic stuffs for schools. And, you know, if you live in an area with sort of richer parents where they can afford to, you know, organise PTA events and what have you, they're going to raise more money than other schools that are in perhaps poorer and more deprived areas. So there is a real issue about funding for schools. And I think, but I say, the way to deal with that is to invest more in our schools. And something that I've been working on incredibly hard over the last year is around funding for special educational needs and disabilities in particular. So Hertfordshire gets less money per pupil per head than other neighbouring and comparable counties. And I've been trying to get information out of Hertfordshire County Council about why that is. And I only recently got that information just before Christmas, and I've written to the minister asking if they'll look at the particular circumstances affecting Hertfordshire and increase the amount of money that we get for special educational needs and disabilities. But on this particular issue, I think, you know, as I understand it, charity law is pretty clear that any kind of charity that exists for educational purposes gets these tax breaks by virtue of being a particular charity. And the answer for me is actually making sure that where there are private schools in a community, that those private schools are have the right incentives in place to make sure that they are opening up their facilities to other state schools. And many of them do that, including here in St Albans, whether it's new theatres or gyms or swimming facilities or playing fields, whatever it might be. So they should be there as a community resource. But the answer really for other schools is just to get a government that's going to invest in education and take our children's future seriously.
James has asked, Daisy, will you be backing the Save St Albans Fight the Freight campaign? We cannot allow our area to be ruined by this monstrosity.
Yeah, well, not only am I backing it, I think I'm taking a leading role in it. So I spoke at a recent Hertfordshire County Council meeting and spoke against their proposal to sell the land, which would enable this enormous strategic rail freight interchange to be built. It's completely in the wrong location. There are lots of rail freight terminals around the country. They normally have a connection to a major motorway. They're normally built in the middle of nowhere, so they're surrounded by fields. And what the government has proposed to do here is to build it right between sort of Park Street and Napsby Park, right sandwiched between two built-up residential areas, and without any major road onto a motorway. And that could potentially cause, you know, huge issues on our local roads and have a huge impact on our local environment as well, if we have HGV lorries and all the rest, you know, piling up in the local area. So, I mean, I've been opposed to this since even before I was elected. I've raised it in Parliament and had debates. I spoke at a recent Hertfordshire County Council meeting. I've challenged Hertfordshire County Council to publish all the legal advice it's received so far, and that was a successful campaign. They initially refused to publish the legal advice, but after I pressured them, they changed their minds. They've also, thanks to a petition signed by lots of residents, agreed to seek out new legal advice. And I'm now pressurising Hertfordshire County Council to release that new advice. And we'll see whether or not they agree to do that.
So turning it to another important local issue, and Sam says, I think the council should addition buskers and street performers like they do in London with any underground performers. I like live music and I think it adds to the community vibe of the city, but some people playing music are too loud and it disrupts the usual calm of the area.
Well, I'm a huge fan of buskers and street performers too. All I would say to Sam is that there is currently a consultation being run by the local district council, just asking people for their views on whether they like the buskers or not, and what kind of buskers they like and what have you. It's a genuinely open consultation for people to give their views. And so if Sam and others want to do that, then I'd encourage them to respond to the consultation or write to their local district councillors.
Now, I think this was an interesting, maybe a cheeky question from Claire here, but she said, could the local area have a New Year's resolution of filling the potholes in the roads?
Well, yeah, I think we're all in favour of that, Claire. The challenge we have here is that Hertfordshire County Council is in charge of the highways, and Hertfordshire County Council has a very, as far as I can tell, a very bizarre way to choosing which potholes should be filled in and when. And we often find that it's the small non-priority ones that get sorted and the really large ones get left for ages. And sometimes they're not fixed very well, which means that they then, you know, they kind of reappear as problems in a year's time or so. So I'm very sympathetic. I'm very sympathetic to Claire wanting our potholes to be filled in. All I would say, if she's got particular ones in mind, then please contact your county councillor, as well as reporting it on the county council's own website. And then we can chase it up and try and get them fixed.
Excellent information there. Now, Michael has said he's very sad that the council are closing Verulamium Park Golf Course. It was nice for local people. My boys and I played there for 20 years since they were very little. If it must go, can we make sure it remains open for public use like a park?
Yeah, so as I mentioned earlier in the interview today, the issue we have is that, you know, inflation's gone through the roof. The government had the disastrous mini budget, and we're now feeling the effects of that. And unfortunately, our local district council, like all local councils, are going to have to make really difficult decisions. And this is sadly one of them. So the district council has concluded that it's going to have to close this particular golf course, and you know, the reason for closing down some of these facilities is because we have to protect core services that we're required in law to actually perform. So my understanding is that the district council is going to retain the land for public use, as that's been suggested here. So my understanding is they are going to do that, but I know that the golf course is loved by some, sadly not loved by enough, and it hasn't really had that many users. There's been a few initiatives to try and drive up the number of people that are using it. Those haven't been successful, and I think anybody who's a member there, I believe, will be able to transfer their membership to the Batchwood golf course instead at the same rates. So there is some information about that on the district council website, and hopefully Michael and others can find that there.
Now, Maya has the final question of January 2023 for you. She's asked, Daisy, do you have any New Year's resolutions?
Do you know what? I don't normally make New Year's resolutions because they just never work for me. But I am going to try and get a little bit fitter this year. So we'll see how that goes.
Oh, excellent. Do you have like a plan, a regime, or are you just kind of going with the flow?
Well, I've got a kettlebell and I've started doing some kettlebell routines at home, and I've been for a few runs and with little sort of sprint sessions in Clarence Park. So we'll see how we go.
Yeah, I've seen some of your social media posts on it as well. I think you're doing an excellent job, Daisy. So we'll keep track as we chat to you through the year. But for now, I'm going to wish you the best of luck with that, the best of health, and we will see you again very, very soon.
Good stuff. Take care.
So thank you very much for listening to this week's episode of The Politics Show. As mentioned at the start, this is a cut from each of the three interviews with our local politicians. So if you want to listen to the full interview, you can head over to the Mix 92.6 FM website. We will be returning next week for another politics interview. So see you again next Sunday at the same time.